Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Peter King in Orlando. A federal judge in Houston has sided with Texas and eight other states, declaring the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program to be illegal. That program has allowed so-called dreamers brought to the U.S. as children to stay here. Veronica Garcia is an attorney with the Immigration Legal Resource Center.
We expected this court and this judge to rule against DACA. He has already done it in the past. We expected him to do the same this time. It's still upsetting because it leaves so many people in limbo.
There will be no action against DACA recipients for now, and the case is likely headed to the U.S. Supreme Court for the third time. United Auto Workers Union President Sean Fain says members are prepared to strike if there's no new contract by tomorrow night. They want higher wages, better benefits, and more.
The big three can afford to immediately give us our fair share. If they choose not to, then they're choosing to strike themselves, and we are not afraid to take action.
Days after New Mexico's governor suspended an open carry gun law, a judge says she overstepped her authority and has issued a temporary restraining order. CBS's Lana Zack is in Albuquerque.
Mark Abramson is a gun shop owner.
I cannot fathom how this is anything other than an attention getter.
The county's Democratic Sheriff John Allen feels that the governor's act was unconstitutional.
There's not enough law enforcement to go around and enforce this order when we're supposed to be going after criminals on the street and not after law-abiding citizens.
So what are the solutions?
You have red flag laws. You implement with your senators and your representatives other laws that they think might help bring down gun violence.
This is the day the running stopped for escaped killer Danilo Cavalcante. He's back in jail after his capture this morning in Chester County, Pennsylvania. District Attorney Deb Ryan.
Our nightmare is finally over and the good guys won.
Cavalcante escaped 2 weeks ago after being sentenced to life in prison for killing a former girlfriend. President Biden has announced additional investments in the Cancer Moonshot program for cancer research, as well as prevention and diagnosis for other diseases.
The goal is to mobilize a whole-of-country effort to cut American cancer rate deaths in half in the next 25 years, or sooner, God willing, and to boost support for patients and families in the process.
Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney says he's not running for re-election.
Frankly, it's time for a new generation of leaders. They're the ones that need to make the decisions that will shape the world they will be living in.
The Dow lost 70 points. Today, this is CBS News.
You need to hire fast and hire right? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. A judge has decided that Anessa Weyer, one of the girls involved in the Slender Man case, no longer needs to wear a GPS tracker because she's followed the terms of her release from a state mental hospital 2 years ago. Weyer was 12 years old when she and Morgan Geiser stabbed their 12-year-old friend. Weyer was released from state custody 2 years ago, while Geiser remains in the state mental hospital and may seek release next year. Developers have proposed replacing the former Boston store at Mayfair Mall with more than 900 apartments. Their plans involve four buildings, each with 15 stories. The entire project carries a price tag of $400 million, although the exact financial contribution from the city of Wauwatosa, which owns the land beneath the old Boston store, remains unclear. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Yeah. Todd Albo would normally be sharing his dulcet tones with us, but you'll recall that last week, Todd was having issues with the cable company, with an internet connection. I'm now thinking, Todd Albo, did you break Spectrum? Are you responsible for this ESPN mess?
I seem to broke everything else, so it wouldn't surprise me, no.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8.
On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Effectiveness of lumping in potential allies with the fossil fuel industry and those responsible for delaying action. But in a press conference, new U.S. Open champion, 19-year-old Coco Gauff, whose semifinal match was interrupted, says she accepts climate science and sympathizes with their goals.
You know, I 100%, you know, believe in that. I think there's things that we can do better. The moments like this, yeah, are history-defining moments. And like I said, I prefer it not to happen in my match, but I wasn't pissed at, you know, the protesters. You know, I always speak about preaching about what you feel and what you believe in. And it was done in a peaceful way, so I can't get too mad of it.
Good for her. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about, the fact that we have chosen through our government to more than double childhood poverty is a disgrace. It's an absolute disgrace. And look, we need to hold those accountable who push for this. And I keep coming back to, we know who they are. There are Republican colleagues. There are the folks who, you know, we want government so small we can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. There should be no social safety net. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, especially you kids. And if you're hungry enough and desperate enough, maybe we can get you a job in the meatpacking plant, you know, cleaning the saw blades. That's where we're heading because of the people that we've put into power. It's disgraceful. But here to share some thoughts on maybe how we got here and why we're here, I've asked Amy Hanauer to come talk with us. Amy is the executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP.org, the website. Amy, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, nice to be here, Rick.
So walk me through these numbers. I mean, I saw these numbers yesterday from the Census Bureau, and it to me just infuriated me and disgraceful. How'd we get here?
Yeah, well, here's the deal. In 2021, we decided to expand the child tax credit and put out the stimulus checks and do some little expansions to the earned income tax credit because we knew that unemployment was going to be spiking, you know, that people were struggling, that the economy was going through a really rough period. And lo and behold, we managed to cut child poverty in half that year. We brought child poverty to the lowest rate that had ever been recorded, 5.2%. And it was just like, despite the fact that lots of parents were unemployed and lots of people were really struggling, lots of people had their hours cut, we had the lowest child poverty numbers on record. But at the end of that period, you know, in late 2021, we couldn't get our policymakers to agree to keep that policy in place. And so as a result, we cut back the child tax credit to its previous level And we just got the numbers for 2022. And it turns out that child poverty more than doubled compared to 2021. It increased by the highest rate ever recorded. And it's basically where it was, you know, back in 2018 and 2019, back up around 12.5%. So we kind of saw that it's a policy choice to have higher rates of child poverty, that we had this simple policy, we put it in place, and it did the trick, even in the roughest economy that we'd seen in a long time.
And what was the, you know, because as I remember, it was an extra $250 a month for kids over six, $300 a month for kids under six, which doesn't sound like an awful lot of money. But when you start and you think about the fact that, you know, minimum wage is still $7.25, that kind of help, you know, I can see why it did what it did. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah. I mean, over the course of the year, the maximum amount would have increased was instead of being $2,000 per kid, it would have been $3,600 for little kids under the age of five, or five and younger, I should say, and $3,000 for age kids age six and older. And so it was just like, you know, over the course of the year, it was enough extra money that, you know, that you could afford kind of the basics. And that's, in fact, what people spent it on. You know, there have been some analyses and like people spent it on food. They spent it on clothing. They spent it on school supplies. They paid their utility bills and they covered the rent with it. And, you know, that was what it was spent on. And it helped all families, right? It helped a lot of working class and middle class families, but it's especially meaningful if you're really struggling to make ends meet and you get an extra $3,600. You know, that really is meaningful.
You know, I when this happened, and I remember it vividly when it went away, and I remember talking about the cruelty of taking this away. Because, you know, I, as I've talked about on the show before, I grew up in a housing project. My mother was on and off welfare a number of times through my childhood because, you know, the 70s were not a great time for single mothers. They were the last hired, first fired. And, you know, to make ends meet, sometimes you had to go on welfare and get help. And it never lasted till the end of the month. And I opined on this idea of, you know, what an extra, you know, $50 or $100 a month would have meant to her and ultimately to our family during that period. And then I said, you know, look, you know, giving it to us and saying that, hey, we're going to help and there's going to be a better possibility, and then yanking it away, that seems incredibly cruel. So having had this program to let kids know that, you know, someone did care about them for a little bit and their lives got a little bit better, and then to have it ripped away like this, that just seems cruel to me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, the funny thing is, I mean, we couldn't get any of the Republicans to get behind it. And I think in the end, Senator Joe Manchin was skeptical and he wanted work requirements. And there's a lot of like, you know, debate that like people are going to not work because they're getting a couple $1,000 a year to help them raise their kids. And that was another thing that's really been disproven by the research. Like when they talked to people, not only did people say, no, like that's not enough money to like quit my job over, but like to the contrary, a lot of people said, actually, this helped me go to work, right? Because it meant that I knew I could put my kids in a safer place and, you know, I could pay the neighbor a couple bucks extra to watch my kids or whatever it was. So there's been no evidence that it disrupted parental employment, but it was enough to give people childcare and help them or give people the time to finish school. So I think you're absolutely right. It's really kind of a cruelty to say we're the richest country on the planet. We're richer than we've ever been. We're willing to give huge subsidies to corporations, huge corporate tax breaks, but we're not willing to do this thing that helps families kind of make ends meet.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Amy Hanauer. Amy is the executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. You can check out their website, itep.org, ITEP.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can check out the work that they do. So now that we've laid this out and we know how bad this policy choice was, that we've chosen to more than double childhood poverty. We've chosen to more than double the number of children who are going to go to bed hungry. What are we going to do about it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of things that can be done. First of all, you know, a lot of people are like using this as a clear bargaining chip. Anytime that the Republicans want any kind of corporate tax break, we're going to say, no way is there that should there be a corporate tax break unless we get the child tax credit restored. And that was a fight that we had again at the end of 2022. And, you know, we didn't get the child tax credit restored, but we did manage to get them to not be able to pass another big corporate tax break. So that was like a partial victory in that way. I think the other thing is that states can take up the mantle, and a lot of states are doing so. I got a couple numbers for you, but, you know, states can pass their own earned income tax credits and they can pass their own child tax credits. And 14 states now have a child tax credit. There are new ones, a whole bunch of new ones passed this year. They're larger than ever before. There are 5 states, Colorado, Minnesota, New Jersey, Oregon, Vermont, that are giving refundable child tax credits of above $1,000 per kid. So this is another way that states can kind of say, look, if the federal government's not going to do this, we want to step up. And I think that's part of it. But, you know, we got to hold our senators and members of Congress accountable. It's ridiculous. As you said, it's cruel. And look, we've got a bunch of business tax breaks that they are just only too happy to hand over. Yeah. And this is a more important policy.
Yeah. How much did this program, because I say we could end childhood hunger. We could we quite easily could. I'm sure some corporate tax breaks being, you know, rescinded could help with that. Maybe, I don't know, a billionaire tax, you know, could help part of it. But how much was this? You know, how much did we save by having more hungry children? In fact, almost 60% more. How much did we save in this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and save is a funny word, and we could talk about that a little bit more. But I mean, the credit as we have it right now costs about $125 billion. And having the more generous benefit in place. So we have a child tax credit, right? We do provide a child tax credit, and it's good, and it pulls people out of poverty and it helps families. Having the more generous benefit in place that cut child poverty down to historic lows would have cost about $100 billion more. And so, you know, that's not nothing, right? But what's important to remember is we have these business tax breaks that the Republicans are clamoring to have in place. Accelerated depreciation, that costs $67 billion for just the top 25 corporations that use it the most, right? We've got research expensing. We've got loose limits on interest deductions. I mean, we've got expanded small business expensing. We've got these overseas tax breaks. I mean, we just have tax break after tax break for these large corporations. We've got tons of multinational corporations stowing their profits overseas and hiding them from the American government. So, you know, the question is, where do you want to put those tax breaks? And then I'll just say one more thing, because you were saying, like, what do we save? You know, it's not really savings at all, right? Because when kids are going to bed hungry, they're not going to be able to thrive in school. They're not going to be able to learn much. They're going to be less able to graduate. They're going to be less able to get a good job when they're out of school. So we end up paying in the long run because we're too cheap in the short run, even though we have the money in this really wealthy country.
No, you're right. We used to understand, penny wise and pound foolish? Wasn't that the saying?
Right. Right.
And this is one of those things. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because ultimately, you know, I hope this embarrassment is something that makes our elected leaders move to action. Although I'm sure my Republican friends don't seem to care, because it doesn't appear to faze them. What should we be doing to push to get something done? What should folks be doing, and what should we be demanding?
Yeah, I mean, I think that absolutely it's like, you know, pushing your member of Congress, pushing your senator, And just saying, like, restore the full child tax credit. I mean, it's as simple as that. Restore the full child tax credit, cut poverty in half. So it's as simple as that at the federal level. And at the state level, you know, demand, like, I don't know if you've got audience members in every state, but demand that your state add a state child tax credit. That's like another way of taking this on. And look, in states, most of our tax codes in states are upside down, where you got low-income families paying a higher share of their income in taxes than the wealthiest families are paying. And you got middle-income families paying a higher share than the wealthiest families are paying. So there's plenty of money in states to take this on. We got plenty of corporate tax breaks in states too. So there's plenty of ways that people could be taking this on. But the simple message is restore the full child tax credit and cut child poverty back in half.
There you go. But again, it comes down to our priorities, our values. Show me a budget and I'll show you your values. Amy, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, always great to talk to you, Rick. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, our good friend Amy Hanauer. Make sure you check out their website, itep.org, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, itep.org. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Got an email from Taylor saying, podcast listener here, so I'm a day behind the show. Your segment on child poverty, your personal experience with it really moved me. You're right in saying that the pro-lifers aren't really pro-life, as they only care about fetuses and nothing after that. To make that more clear, I think you should start referring to them as forced birthers, as it's clearly defined what their ideology is all about. Love the show. Appreciate it, Taylor. And look, you know, at the end of this, you know, not wrong. They don't seem to give a rat's behind about these kids going hungry. And it should make us just downright angry. I mean, seriously, the things that... let's go to the phones. We've got Steve on line one. Steve, how are you?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And I think it's such an important topic because, as you've already alluded to, these are people who are basically saying, that, okay, we want to have a thriving, vibrant workforce. We're Americans and America first. And, you know, they've sold themselves as the party and the interest that is America first. But on the other hand, nothing about their public policy interest would indicate that. Well, Americans want to be able to feed their children, send them to decent schools, provide them with a college education. Yet the Republican Party is for none of this. They don't want to help you at any point along this process, except when it comes to the case of mandating that you have a child that you may or may not want to have. So, and it's always amused me because at some point you are going to have to pay for this sooner or later. We know that there's a correlation between what we spend on children in terms of their early development, in terms of their education, and how much money you're going to spend down the road in terms of welfare, unemployment benefits, how much you're going to have to spend on the prison industrial system, all of that. So if you can spend a dollar now that saves you $100 down the road, wouldn't you want to do that? But we live in a society, unfortunately, where it's this, as long as I'm taken care of and mine are taken care of, and then if I live in a neighborhood and my neighbors and I want to come together and spend a lot of money because we all live in very nice homes and pay for a nice educational system that's predicated upon the value of our homes, which is how we fund education in this country, then that's fine. But there will be no statewide educational program, with the exception of some states that do have things like state income tax and a state program for primary and secondary educational funding. But there is no national educational funding. We local school districts get about 10 to 12% of their funding from the national government in terms of how we fund education. So make no mistake, the quality of education your kids get is dependent upon what kind of home you can afford and your neighbors can afford, yeah, and how much they're willing to pay in taxes to help educate children. And is that any way for society to exist moving forward in a global economy which is going to demand more and more of those kids be cognitively developed at an earlier age, be ready to compete in a global workforce? I mean, I don't know where these people think they're going to make that money that they're hoping to save by not contributing to the greater good down the road, because it's going to come back to bite them sooner or later. When we can't compete on the global stage anymore, what's going to happen? And I'll answer my own question in that regard. You know, the only people that many Republicans expect to be patriotic are people who have very little. When it comes to the uber wealthy, no, there's nothing patriotic about their money. Their money is all over the place globally. You know, so they have no particular allegiance to this country except for the degree to which this country can protect their interests.
Yep.
So if they have intellectual property rights, we need the Justice Department to keep China from ripping off the thing that, you know, the company that I've invested in has created. Then we need the U.S. government. But if I need to pay taxes to that government, I'm going to hide my money in various other places because I don't want to do that part of it. So, you know, I mean, again, it's just amazing that people continue to vote Republican in this country, thinking that somehow that they are the party of patriotism and what defines a true American.
No, I'm right there with you. But ultimately, don't you think it comes down to the fact that, you know, we're not going to help those people? And we know who the image of those people are. But the reality is, you know, there are a lot more broke, poor white people, especially in red states that have the highest poverty rates. They're the ones suffering. And look, as someone who lives in a northern state who pays a higher tax rate than most, and a state that pays more into the federal government than they get back, you know, I'm okay with that because I don't want children to go hungry.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because you raise a great point there. You know, the image that we have of the welfare queen, you know, and what, you know, people like Matt Gaetz call the couch potato and so forth, you know, that is a person of color. And so that when you look at societies that are more willing to help, it turns out that Northern Europe, which, you know, is much more social democratic, what we call democratic socialist in this country. Well, when you're a homogeneous society, you know, it's easy for Norwegians to say, yeah, I'm willing to help a lot of other Norwegians who have less than I do because they look like I do.
Right.
But when it comes to a heterogeneous society such as this, turns out that a lot of people who are middle class, upper middle class, and so forth, especially older people, they look at who, the people who need, and they don't see anyone who looks like them. They're misguided in that regard because the vast majority of people who are in need look like them. And by the way, the people who tend to need for about 2 years before they re-enter the workforce, before they can go off of welfare, as it were. This idea that people spend decades on welfare, yes, there are a handful that do so. The vast majority of people who need help in this country do not stay on welfare for years. It's less than 2 years, and then they're back there working in the workforce just like everybody else. A majority of the people who receive aid in this country are working people, because you do still get to qualify for some aid if you don't make enough money.
Yep.
And so, you know, we've got all of these images of people sitting around wearing designer clothing, playing video games, and watching expensive cable television while everybody else works, and they just lead the life of Riley. And that is not what's going on in America.
Well, no, I grew up in a housing project. I know that's not reality. But Steve, I appreciate the thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, I mean, you know, the reality is, and Steve makes an interesting point. You know, the patriotic, the patriotism for the poor. You know, we send them off to fight and die in wars, all of that. But when we start talking about taxing rich people, what's the first thing they say? Well, they'll just move. They'll move out of the state. They'll move out of the country. They'll take their money and they'll run. And this, again, is another one of these weird moments where, as working people, we should be coalescing around the idea. And I don't care which party, you know, find me someone who's going to help working people. Find someone who's going to ensure that my work is is compensated fairly. You know, it's interesting that Steve brings up the fact that, you know, the majority of people who collect food stamps and get government assistance actually have jobs. One of the biggest welfare queens in the country is Walmart, because, you know, their employees, lots of public benefits, because they don't pay enough. I've often said I want to make sure that everyone has a job. I'm not against work requirements. I'm against work requirements that don't have any work. So for me, if you have a program where government is the employer of last resort, where if, you know, in my neighborhood where I grew up, we weren't on the bus line, there weren't jobs within walking distance. It's the government who should step in and fill that void and create the competition to make sure that wages can support a family, to make sure that wages can put food on the table, a roof over the head, and have health care when people get sick, and some retirement security when they get old. The question is, what kind of a society do we want? Do we want the society as we've been talking about for years? I mean, you know, you go back to John Edwards and the two Americas, the haves and the have-nots. Do we want that? Is that the future that we want? Or do we want to have a future where you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead? I know where I want to be. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day that the state police stormed Attica Correctional Facility in New York. 4 days earlier, the inmates had taken over the prison. One guard was killed. The guards were members of AFSCME Council 82. The prisoners demanded improvements to their brutal living conditions in the overcrowded prison. Police retook most of the prison, but the inmates held guards hostage in cell block D. One of the prisoners, Elliot James Barkley, explained the takeover. "We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not depend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disrespect for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States." When the police stormed the prison, they dropped tear gas from helicopters. They fired 3,000 rounds, firing on prisoners and hostages indiscriminately. They killed 29 inmates and 10 hostages. Police claimed the prisoners had killed the hostages. They also accused the inmates of committing atrocities against the guards. Public outrage swelled against the inmates, including racially charged hate directed at the black prisoners. But autopsies proved that all of those killed had been felled by police bullets. Attica became the rallying cry for those concerned about prison conditions. It has been referenced by many in movies and songs, including John Lennon's Attica State. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Last week, I talked about how Labor Day was created in the 1880s by rebellious workers. But I'm celebrating the spirit again this week because a momentous new energy has been building in today's union movement. Indeed, renewed union rebelliousness has put labor back in Labor Day. Previously cast as a day off, it's now a day on, rallying working-class activism and celebrating nationwide strikes by such disparate groups as Teamsters and Hollywood actors. This is making the corporate bosses very antsy, for it's the harbinger of a new order that is undermining absolutist boss rule. Particularly alarming to the plutocratic establishment is the new aggressiveness of the United Auto Workers Union under their recently elected grassroots president, Sean Fain. Tossing aside the old willingness to accept incremental changes in contract negotiations, Fain began the current bargaining round by literally throwing the industry's proposal in the wastebasket, bluntly declaring that's where it belongs. Such honesty has spooked Detroit's auto barons, who are wailing that the workers' demands are, quote, excessive. This from pampered CEOs, each pocketing between $20 and $34 million a year in personal pay. Pathetically, the corporate establishment has no better retort to feign than to try its tired old Red Scare bugaboo. This man studied Trotsky, squealed one squeamish corporatist on TV. No. Instead, Sean Fain has clearly studied Walter Reuther, Mother Jones, Fighting Bob La Follette, Frederick Douglass, Cesar Chavez, and other American champions of economic fairness and social justice. This is Jim Hightower saying, the big story here is not that a president of one workers' organization is shaking things up, but that organized workers themselves are on the move, demanding economic democracy.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the hours are ticking down to a potential strike with the UAW and the Big Three. And look, this is, you know, in my view, I think it's probably going to happen because I don't know that the Big Three are ready to meet the demands of the workers at this moment. Hope I'm wrong. But you look at the massive profits of these big companies and you just go, at some point, they've got to share some of it. But this didn't just happen. This has been decades of assaults on workers in this industry. And I had a bunch of emails yesterday, of folks saying, look, you know, I worked at the Flint plant back in the 80s and this happened. And I remember the Reagan high dollar policies that made Japanese imports much cheaper that crushed our industry and on and on and on. And the assault on these workers over the years, it's finally built to a head to where they're saying no more. And that's why I've asked Scott Holderson to come talk with us. Scott is the UAWD Steering Committee Chairperson. He's also a former Vice President of UAW Local 551. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Rick. I really, really love the show and happy to talk about the UAW and what's been going on.
Now, you know, as I said here a second ago, the fact that I think you're at a boiling point right now of decades of attacks on your members, decades of concessionary contracts and two-tiered wage systems and all of these things that have just been, well, basically shoved down your throat. I think you're at a breaking point. Am I assessing this properly?
Yeah, I'd say you're assessing it very well. We've been taking decades of concessions, and they really went into high gear in the last 20 years. And we're ready to fight to get back what was stolen from us by these companies.
Now you've been a UAW member how many years?
34 years.
And over your lifespan, things getting better, getting worse. How much worse, if that's the case? Walk me through the last 34 years.
Well, it's been concessionary contract after concessionary contract, but things really went into high gear back in 2007. Before the bankruptcies, the UAW agreed to a two-tier wage and benefit structure. And, in my estimation at the time, that was the dumbest concession that we could have possibly made because these companies were facing bankruptcy. We all knew it. But when you're facing bankruptcy, you're not hiring anyone. So a two-tier wage and benefit structure does nothing to keep you from going into bankruptcy. So that was one of the worst of the concessions back in 2007. And, then in 2009, they took away some of our bonuses and pay increases that were in the contract. They took away our cost of living allowance, which at the time was 99 cents an hour. And that was basically a dollar an hour wage cut. Since then, our wages have been stagnating with you know, inflation going through the roof. Since 2005, we've had 2-3% wage increases. That's it.
Wow. So basically what you're earning today is what you were earning 34 years ago.
Yeah. Well, not 34 years ago, but 20 years ago.
No, because, you know, this is one of those things. I remember when I first entered, we're probably about the same age. When I entered the workforce, you know, those auto worker jobs, those were the gold standard. Those were solid upper middle class jobs with good wages. There was hard work. The assembly line work is not easy. You busted your behind. But the wages, the benefits, all of that stuff were top tier. And now, you know, I'm looking at the wages, you know, $17 an hour at the low end, $32 at the top end. That's not.
Yeah, we've obviously lost a lot of ground. When I started in 1989, the starting wage was $12 and some change. In 34 years, it's only gone up. The starting wage has only gone up about $4 an hour.
And there's no economic gimmickry there. That's dollar for dollar.
That's dollar for dollar. Yeah. That's not including, inflation rate or any of that. Workers now are starting at 16 and some change. I was starting at 20 and some change. Or I'm sorry, 12 and some change. And, that's 34 years ago. And that was the starting rate. It took me 18 months to get to top pay. Now workers are starting as temporary workers, being in precarious, basically a probationary status for years on end. And then when they finally get seniority, their time starts then, not when they first got hired. And then they have an 8-year progression.
Wow.
So that's the kind of thing that we're fighting against right now to reverse. And, President Sean Fain is really laying it all on the table. This contract negotiation is different than anything I've ever witnessed in the UAW. And, as I said, I'm a UAW member for 34 years.
And good on them. Now, what's getting the attention, and every time I hear Sean Fain's name, it's always the union boss is demanding these outrageous, these outrageous demands, 46% pay increase and 32-hour work week. I got to tell you, having listened to what you just laid out, 46% increase doesn't sound anywhere near enough.
No, I mean, you consider that, contracts, in the past had like 3% wage increases every year. By not having those wage increases for the past 15 years at least, 20 years, 3% over 20 years is 60%.
Right. Now, where did the 46% number come from?
I'm not sure where the 46% came from, but I know the 40% is what it's been kind of rounded to, and that's the increase that the CEOs of these companies have gotten over the past 4 years.
Right. That's what was my understanding. The 46% number came out of that's what the executives pocketed over the last 4 years. So it's simply saying, look, you gave yourself this. How about paying the people who actually get down on the shop floor, sweating their you-know-what's off, busting their knuckles, doing the hard work? How about we help them?
Well, and we're the source of their profits. If it weren't for the work that we do, there would be no profits. So, that's the whole, the whole rub of the situation is that, we've been left behind. We've made these immense profits for these companies, and it's time for us to get our fair share.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things that I just learned, and because we heard a lot about, you know, I've got right-wing friends who think, you know, when the bankruptcy happened, you know, Obama bailed you guys out and you guys got a sweetheart deal and all of this stuff. And I said, look, the reason people are ticked off about what happened during that period is you guys didn't lose your pensions like everyone else had in the past. And maybe this was a good way to start for the future to make sure workers don't take it on the chin every time a company bankrupts itself. But you guys took a beating during that bankruptcy that I don't think enough people understand. The concessions you took, the pain, the suffering that workers took through that, and now they're wildly profitable. I saw, what was it, $250 billion in profit over the last couple of years. You go, hey, when times were tough, you came to us with your hand out going, give us back. But now that the times are fat and happy, we can't share. There's something just unfair. There's something wrong with that, I think.
Yeah, and in addition to giving up wage increases and bonuses in those bankruptcy years, we gave up a very important thing that was cost of living allowance, and that allowed our wages to keep up with inflation. And by not having that, it was actually termed as suspended until the companies got back on their feet. Well, in my estimation, they've been back on their feet for well over a decade. They've made $250 billion in the last decade. And, President Fain put it so succinctly when he said what $250 billion is. It's hard to wrap your head around that number. It's just, an astronomical number. But you could have bought every Major League Baseball team, every National Hockey League team, and every National Basketball Association team, and then still had $50 billion left over to buy season's tickets for every season ticket holder.
I mean, that's an obscene amount of money. I mean, it really is. And this is another one of these moments where you look and you go, where did it go? You guys go, you do the work, you create this wealth, this profit, and then it's divvied up against our board of directors, our CEOs, and the shareholders. When does it trickle down?
Tonight, President Fain had a Facebook Live presentation, and it showed that the stock buybacks and the dividends to shareholders had increased over the last 4 years by 1,500%. That's where all the money went. It went back to shareholders and dividends. CEO pay only went up 40%. UAW workers pay went up 6% in the last 4 years. So, all the money is going to the top, and that's what's causing the imbalance in the wealth distribution in our country and in the world for that matter. But definitely, in our country, we've seen the distribution of wealth go to the very few at the very top, and everybody else is getting left behind. So we are fighting turn that around and get the workers their fair share, not only here, but this is going to raise the standard for workers across the country. At least that's our hope.
And the other important part of this, and this is where, again, I think unions need to really start focusing on the next generation of jobs. One of the demands is, as EVs come online, that those jobs are UAW jobs, and we streamline into that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Well, that's an existential threat to the union. What they're trying to do is have these joint ventures for battery plants, and through that exclude the workers that are making the internal combustion engines that have made these incredible profits over the last 10 years and just leave them by the sidelines. You know, when throw them away when they're done with them, as they've done with, you know, with union workers for the past 20 years. In the past 20 years, they've closed, these three companies have closed 65 plants. Those are 65 communities that are suffering because of the loss of jobs, the loss of tax base, families being separated, families having to uproot and move across the country to be able to keep their jobs, but leave behind the little league and the churches and the schools. You know, it's just devastating to the communities across this country. And these corporations, they just don't care.
I'm right there with you. What do you say to the person, Scott, who says, it's just too much? You know, 32-hour work week, 46% increase in wages, you know, defined benefit pension for all workers. You know, just way too much. What do you say to that?
Well, I say that, you know, these companies could afford that, you know, in their heyday in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s. We had all of that. When we went to a four-day work week schedule, we still had overtime after 8 hours. What's 4 times 8? That's 32. That's a 32-hour work week. We're just asking for what we had before.
Right.
And, you know, with the 40%, we've lost 60% of you know, in wage increases that we should have gotten over the last 20 years. So, you know, we're not asking for the moon here. We're just asking to have a lifestyle that used to be called the American dream, right? Where you could raise your family, have a little extra money for some leisure activities. We're not asking to get rich. We're not asking to be wealthy. The CEOs are making $20 to $29 million a year. We don't want that in our lifetime.
Yeah, that's crazy. The hours are ticking down. Any prediction? Do we think that a strike is imminent? Are you hearing anything positive that might give you hope that a strike can be averted? What are your thoughts?
Well, the companies have been moving a little closer, but they're still not close enough. There's still, you know, a little more than 24 hours left. And, you know, if the companies are serious about maintaining their profits that we've been making for them, then they'll open those pocketbooks up and you know, come across with a deal that makes our members whole. We're not asking for anything, you know, outrageous. We're asking for the standard of living that auto workers had before these companies used the economic crisis to come after us and try and break the American dream.
I got to tell you, I wish you guys the best. I hope a strike can be averted, but ultimately, if it has to happen, wish you one day longer, one day stronger. I hope you'll come back and share with us as this continues down the road. I'd love to have you keep us up to date on what's going on.
Yep. Glad to be here and love your show and thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it. Scott Holdson. Make sure you check out their website, uawd.org. Unite All Workers for Democracy is what that stands for. He's part of the steering committee there. Also, he was a former UAW Vice President, Local 551. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2013. Riot police used tear gas and water cannons to clear out Zocalo Square in Mexico City. The square was occupied by protesting teachers. The teachers had been on strike for weeks. They wanted changes made to educational reforms that had been passed by the Mexican government. The education reforms included new performance-related testing for teachers. But the reforms did little to address the economic disparity faced by many school children. The evaluation tests did not take into account the difficult conditions for teachers in the poorest regions of Mexico. The teachers worried the tests would lead to mass layoffs. Police wanted to clear Zocalo Square before Mexico's annual independence celebration. Most protesters left peacefully. However, some remained. Police, using armored vehicles and helicopters, clashed with the remaining protesters. Officers tore down protesters' temporary shelters and put out small bonfires. Protesters responded by throwing projectiles at the police. The police arrested many of the remaining protesting teachers. After the square was cleared, a BBC reporter noted that police had achieved their goal. Still, the reporter added, the sight of riot police and armored vehicles in the country's most emblematic plaza is not the image of unity the government wanted to portray hours before President Peña Nieto celebrated his first Independence Day as Mexico's president. If it sounds familiar, it is, because teachers in the United States are dealing with similar issues. Teachers, through their unions, in both the United States and Mexico, fight for a quality education for all children.
We don't need no education.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. I don't do enough pitching the podcast, and I really should. If you miss any, grab it, share with your friends, all of that stuff as well. A couple of emails I want to jump into. Terry in Santa Fe sent me one that reminded me of, you know, in looking at the auto industry, what's happened over the last, you know, 40, 50 years. The Reagan era was horrible for the auto industry. Because ultimately, look, you know, the Reagan high dollar policy was horribly destructive to manufacturing in the U.S. And the auto industry took it, you know, just probably harder than anyone. Well, maybe the steel industry. But, you know, you look at the fact that they went after, just... In enormous ways, working people. And again, it started with the shot heard across the boardroom firing the Patco workers. But the global high dollar policy, this idea that, you know, the dollar was, you know, we got to have a strong dollar, which meant the Japanese could well devalue their currency, which meant Japanese cars were dirt cheap here in the U.S. And you know, look, when you know, people have the option of going, hey, I can buy something cheap and small, since the big three weren't making small cars, it was harmful. And that assault on manufacturing during the Reagan years, this move towards a service-based economy. And I remember, and she reminded me of that time period, because I remember being, you know, told, you know, those dirty factory jobs are going to all go. We don't need those jobs. We don't need those industries. We're all going to have corner offices. We're all going to wear white shirts and ties. And it's going to be the service-based economy, the knowledge economy. And I remember going through high school, you know, people saying, well, you don't need, you know, machine shop or any of that stuff. All that stuff's going to be done overseas. And look, we had machine shop and wood shop and, you know, all that stuff. And I'm very fortunate for that, because I learned an awful lot. But what happened over the years since, they wiped all that stuff out, because Reagan's vision came to fruition. And it wasn't Reagan's. I give him way too much credit. It was the people who owned him, the Business Roundtable. You know, our corporate titans. You know, our million-dollar, $23 million, $29 million CEOs, who it's all about the bottom line. And back to where we started. It's all about having workers in their place. Just be glad you got a job. Just be happy you have a job. Even if it doesn't pay like it used to. And look, I look at the auto worker jobs, and I guess it's one of those special ones for me, because the first time I saw someone get a union job, I was like 8 years old, and it was a UAW job. It was the neighbor got a job at Ford, and immediately their lives got better and quickly. Food at the end of the month, kids got secondhand bikes, they got a secondhand car. They eventually moved out of the neighborhood altogether. Very quickly, their lives got enormously better. And that stuck with me.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.